First, I hope everyone had a wonderful Pesach, and now we're in the Omer, and I'll talk more about this closer to Shavuos when I get back, Mirtz Hashem. But basically, we know that the holiday of Shavuos does not have a calendar date in the Torah. It's very, very interesting. It does not have a calendar date. The Torah does not say anywhere that Shavuos is the 6th of Sivan. Shavuos is the 50th day after counting the Omer, which means it's the 51st day from Pesach. It is only a fortuity that it happens to be the 6th of Sivan, because based on our predetermined calendar, Nisan always has 30 days, and Iyar always has 29 days. So if you count 50 and you move into Sivan, it's going to hit the 6th of Sivan. But before there was a predetermined calendar, when witnesses used to testify when they saw the new moon, any given month could be 30 or 29. So it would have been possible for Nisan and Iyar to be 30-30. It would have been possible for Nisan Iyar to be 29-29. It would have been possible for Nisan Iyar to be 30-29 as we have it. Or Nisan 29 and Iyar 30, which we don't have, but that would come out the same. Now, here is the interesting point. If both Nisan and Iyar are 29, Shavuos will be moved 2 days further into the month of Sivan, making it the 7th of Sivan. If you move it 30-30, it will be the 5th. It's only 30-29 that it'll be the 6th. Meaning to say, Shavuos potentially is a floating holiday. Some years, in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, some years it was the 6th of Sivan. Some years it was the 5th of Sivan. Some years it was the 7th of Sivan. Right, there is nothing automatic that links Shavuos to the 6th of Sivan. Rather, Shavuos is simply defined as the 51st day, or the 50th day of the Omer. You count 49 days and the 50th is Shavuos. Now, the significance of that is the following idea. That Shavuos is not really a separate holiday. Shavuos is simply the end of Pesach. In fact, some Rishonim actually describe the period of the Omer as a long Chol HaMoed. So, if you have a policy of not working Chol HaMoed, you know, you could tell your employer that you don't work Chol HaMoed. On the other hand, the job will probably not be waiting after all that time, and the like. And the reason why, in fact, that's why the Talmudic term, the Mishnaic term for the holiday of Shavuos, is Atzeret. The Torah uses Atzeret for Shemini Atzeret, but the last day of Pesach is also called Atzeret in the Torah. But Shavuos is called by the Chachamim Atzeret, because Atzeret literally means the conclusion or the terminus point, and Shavuos is the end of Pesach, because Pesach is freedom, and Shavuos is Torah, and freedom without Torah is worthless and destructive. And that is why Shavuos is not an autonomous Yom Tov. Shavuos is the end of Pesach, and we link the two Chagim with the counting of the Omer. So this is a period of time for resolving to take the freedom that Hashem has given us and use it to submit to Ol Malchus Shemayim. I mentioned before the beautiful remark of the Indian poet Tagore. Died in the 1920s, I believe, but he had won the Nobel Prize for Literature as a young man. And he gave a beautiful mashal, having nothing to do with Judaism, obviously, but it's about life. And he said that a human being, a soul of a human being, is like a violin string. There is beautiful music in the soul. But we think that if all I would be is free of all the restrictions, the beauty of my soul would come out. Well, take a violin string. If you cut the violin string loose, put it on the kitchen table, a loose string, totally free, totally unencumbered, it will not be able to produce any sound at all. The beauty within is only when it's stretched on the frame and tied down. And Tagori, Chachma Bagayim Tamen, Tagori was saying, the joy and the goodness and the light within a human soul, and certainly within a Jewish soul, can emerge only when it is tied down to be Makabel, the Ol Malchus Shemayim. So we think that mitzvos is a form of enslavement, and it's indeed true, the Torah does use the word that we are Avadim of Hashem. But in reality, Chazal say, Ein ben chorin ela mi she'osek b'Torah. True freedom is only the person who observes and learns the Torah, because once again, that is how the beauty of our neshamas comes out. So that's something to think about during this period of time. But what I wanted to talk about today is something that on one level may appear to be hyper technical, and yet it is fascinating that often in the hyper technical parts of the Torah we can learn great magnificent lessons as to how we structure our spiritual lives. And I want to talk about saras. I want to talk about leprosy. Right? We had the parshios yesterday, a double parsha, Tazria Metzora. Most of Tazria is about saras, and half of Metzora is about saras. And let's talk about that a little bit, and how is it relevant to us. Now, first of all, we understand there is a modern medical condition that still goes by the term leprosy, although that's a bit of an archaic term. Hansen's disease is the official name. But the modern disease that is described as leprosy does not at all correspond with the Torah's disease. The Torah's disease is clearly some type of generally skin condition. In fact, if anything, the word psoriasis comes from psoras. But again, if anyone has psoriasis, don't be afraid. It's not going to be halachic saras for the reasons that we will discuss. But the Rambam, who of course was a very great doctor himself, points out that although saras is a physical condition, it does not come from physical reasons, nor is it a contagious condition. People think, oh, why does the Torah say the Metzora has to go out of the camp and be isolated? Oh, so people want to say, oh, the Torah recognizes the risks of contagious diseases. Well, that would be a great thing, but the Rambam makes the point, it's very clear saras is not contagious, and saras is not a disease in a medical sense. It's a special spiritual punishment that has a physical manifestation. And the Rambam in the Moreh Nevuchim brings a number of proofs. Proof number one is that when a person has saras, he must go to the Kohen. Now, the Kohen was not necessarily a doctor, although the truth of the matter is this is a bit of a weak raya, because people point out that in ancient cultures, the priests were often the doctors. Okay, but the Rambam takes this as a proof. A Kohen is not a doctor. A Kohen is a spiritual leader. If saras was a medical condition, you need to go to a doctor. Elamai, the Kohen is a spiritual doctor, and you go to the Kohen for a spiritual checkup, not a physical checkup. As I say, that particular raya is a bit weak, because in many societies, Kohanim were in fact, or priests were in fact doctors. But the Rambam's second raya is a very, very excellent raya, and that is, since a person does not become a Metzora until the Kohen says he's a Metzora, right, it's like the old line of the baseball umpires, you're not out until I call you out, or it's not a hit until I call it in. So saras is exactly the same thing. You're not a Metzora until the Kohen proclaims. So the Mishnah says a very strange rule. The Mishnah says there are certain times of year in which even if the Kohen knows the person is a Metzora, the Kohen is not supposed to proclaim those words, because that would require quarantine and that would destroy Simcha. And the two cases where you don't do it is Yom Tov and Chol HaMoed, because we don't want to take away the joy of Yom Tov by separating him from his family. And number two, a Chasen or a Kala for the 7 days of rejoicing. Now the Rambam argues, if you're talking about a contagious disease, that makes no sense at all. I mean, imagine if somebody had, had tuberculosis, and it happened to be diagnosed while they're in the Shiva Shemaya Mishta. Are we going to say, well, we don't want to ruin the party, so we'll just let him hang around till the end of the week. Can't do that. That's a danger to the public. So it's muchrich, the Rambam says, that saras is not a contagious disease, but it is a physical manifestation of a spiritual rat that is within, and indeed the Gemara tells us that there are a number of averos for which saras comes, and the most common avera for saras is lashon hara, speaking evil about other people. The word mitzora is motzira, one brings out bad, right, just as this rot from within comes out because you try to expose the rot or the negativities about other people. Now, based on this, the Ramban makes a very, very beautiful point, and this will protect people with psoriasis. And the Ramban says, halachic saras can exist only when there's a Beis HaMikdash and only when there is nevuah. Because saras is a form, although in a negative way, it is a form of prophecy. Hashem is giving the person a direct message as to how he has to improve his life. And that's actually a gift. You know, people often say, you know, I remember when I used to teach law school, you know, many, many years ago, and there's only one exam, right? To know anyone, well, you know, in a lot of graduate schools, there's only one exam at the end of the semester, and, you know, either pass it or don't pass it. I mean, I never failed anybody, but, you know, whatever. And the thing is that students always ask, if I only had some feedback, if I only had, right? And we sometimes say to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, or think, if only Hashem would tell me what I need to rectify, what I need to be misake. Saras was a gift from Hashem, telling the person, this is what you need to work on. And that's why the Ramban says, when we lose the merit of nevuah, and we don't get those direct messages anymore, we lose the burden of saras. Saras correlates with nevuah. Now, there are some exceptional cases. That's why saras is only in Eretz Yisrael. It's only bizman ha-mikdash. It's only bizman ha-nevuah. Now, there are exceptional cases. We read in the Haftarah yesterday. Well, actually, we did because it was Machar HaChadosh. But the normal Haftarah for Mitzrayah is the story of Naaman, who was a non-Jewish general from Syria who got saras, etc. And of course in the Midbar we have Miriam got saras because of Lashon Hara, and even Moshe Rabbeinu at the very beginning of his shlichus, right, when Moshe Rabbeinu said that the Jewish people are not deserving of going free, Hashem made his hand had saras. No, Moshe Rabbeinu. No, I'm talking about two different events. Miriam became a mitzoras in the desert. I'm talking about in Parshat Shemos, at the burning, you know, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe to take out Bnei Yisrael, so Moshe Rabbeinu said, put your hand in your chayk, in your chest, and it came out, and the hand was mitzoras kishelik. It went away right away. But the reason was because Moshe Rabbeinu spoke Lashon Hara on Bnei Yisrael. Because Moshe Rabbeinu said, they are not worthy. Right? Moshe says, I'm not the person to take them out, and they are not worthy of being redeemed. He said two different things. And the Kodesh Baruch Hu said, you can say what you want about yourself, but you don't say they're not worthy. And they, as a little patch, he gave Moshe a little patch, so to speak, by Moshe Rabbeinu's hands turning into Mitzoras. But those are exceptional cases. There was one king of Yehuda, who in fact became a Mitzora, but it's interesting, it's not because of Lashon Hara. This is Uzziyahu, Melech Yehuda, and according to Chazal, Uzziyahu wanted to be a Kohen Gadol as well. He was not a Kohen Gadol, he's from Shevet Yehuda. And he went into the Heichal to bring Ketores, and immediately on his forehead there was the sign of Saras. And for that reason, he actually was semi-retired. He did not, in other words, it says he died, but that's because the Mitzray was considered as a dead person, and his king, Yehoash, his son, took over the Malchus for many, many years. So Yehoash was a Mitzray, the rest of his... But, so those are exceptional cases. But by and large, saras comes because of lashon hara, motzi shemer. Now, saras is a very complicated set of halachos because there are many, many different types of saras. The most common saras that we've been talking about is saras on the flesh. But then there are separate halachas. If it's saras on the hairy part of the body, let's say the hair, the beard, or whatever, that's a separate halacha of saras. And then there's a third group of saras, which comes after burns or bruises. And again, these are complicated because each one has separate halachas. And then there is saras of garments, and then there is saras of houses. Right, so there are different types of human saras, the saras of garments, saras of houses. There is one opinion in the Gemara that says saras of houses and garments never happened. It's only hypothetical. On the other hand, other Bandi Amram say it did happen. So it's one of those machloks in which some people say it happens, some people say it didn't happen. It's hard to understand. You have a similar machlokas by the Ben Sorer Umore, the rebellious son. One opinion says it never happened. And the other opinion says, I was there and I sat on his grave. How do you understand those machloks? It's a difficult as to that. Okay. But because there's so many details here, I just want to focus on the most common saras, to the extent saras is common, which it isn't. That is the saras of the flesh. So what happens here? A person wakes up one morning, and a person finds, in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, in the time of the Mishkan, a person finds a white splotch on their flesh. Are they a mitzorah at that point? No, they're not. They are not a mitzorah because no kohen pronounced it. But there is a halachic obligation to go to a kohen to check it out. You are not allowed to ignore it. There is a mitzvah saseh in the Torah to go to the kohen. The kohen, if he's a Talmud Chacham, the Kohen will issue his own psak. If the Kohen is an Am Haaretz, he can get a Talmud Chacham to help him, but only the Kohen pronounces. It's very interesting that even if the Kohen has to get a Talmud Chacham to paskin on the Tzaras, only the Kohen can issue the actual decision. And what the Talmud Chacham or the Kohen looks at are really two things. The size of the spot. It has to be the size of a gris viot, which is the size of a little more than a bean. By the way, that's the exact same shiur as stains in Hilchos Nida. So if you go back to your Taras Mishpacha refreshers, that is how big a negat saras has to be. Whether it's a penny, a dime, quarter, whatever shiur your kallah teachers told you, etc. But that's the shiur of a negat saras. And in addition, it has to be a shade of white. Now, we're not so sensitive to colors or even the absence of colors, but Chazal identified many, many different types of shades of white. And saras is within a relatively narrow range of the brightest whites, and that would be saras. Okay, so let's say to the person's misfortune, it is determined at that point that the nega is the skin patch, is both big enough and bright enough. So the Kohen declares him to be a Mitzorah, but here's the important thing. And again, I'll get into the lessons of this. He is not a definitive Mitzorah. He is what is called a Muskar. A Muskar is a provisional Mitzorah. And a provisional Mitzorah does go Chutz L'machaneh. He does leave the camp. He is quarantined. He is chutz l'machaneh. But he's not yet a definitive mitzorah. He's there for 7 days. On the seventh day, the Kohen then goes and inspects him for some additional signs, meaning something in addition to the nega has to occur for him to graduate into being mukhlat, a definitive mitzvah. And these are called simanim of tuma. These are signs that make him tameh. And there are three. Either one of them, or any one of them, will upgrade him, or downgrade him, to be a real definitive mitzvah. Either, if there was a black hair in the area, for example, let's say the mitzvah had a splotch on his arm, where there was a black hair, if the black hair turned white, That is a one siman of tumah. Or, these are in the alternative, or the nega grew bigger than it was. Because when the Kohen looked at him initially, the Kohen made a mark or made a circle in ink as to how big it was, and if the nega went beyond that circle, that is called pisayon. Pisayon just means expansion. And the third siman of tumah, which is counterintuitive, because you might think it's positive, is that if in the middle of the nega there appears some clean, healthy flesh, now we would think that that's a sign of healing. No, that's a sign of tumah. So if on day sin any one of those three signs occurs, he graduates from being a muskar mitzora to a mukhlat mitzora. Now once he's mukhlat, he remains a mitzora until the nega goes away, which could be, you know, a year, whatever it would be. And after that time, he has to bring burnt offerings. And then he has to count 7 days and bring other karbanos. And he has to shave all the hair on his body. He has to go through all of those ceremonies. Now, what happens if on day 7, he does not have those simanei tumah? He still has the nega, but he does not have the simanei tumah. He is quarantined for a second 7 days. And on the 14th day, the Kohen once again examines him for one of those three simanim of tumah. If he has any one of them, mukhlat. What if he doesn't? He still has the nega. He's been quarantined for 14 days. He has the tzaras. But if by day 14, he does not have one of the three simanei tumah, he goes home. He no longer has the status of a mitzora. He doesn't have to bring korbanos. He doesn't have to go to the mikvah. He doesn't have to shave his hair. If he does not have a siman tumah by the second week, he goes home even with the nega. Now, there are different rules for the different types of tzaras. We're not going to go into that. I'm just referring to the most common tzaras, which is tzaras or meaning ayin. Tzaras or basar. Tzaras on the flesh, on the skin, and not in an area that has hair like the hair or a beard, or the like, and not coming from bruising or injury. Because again, tzaras is a very technical area. Each type of tzaras has a different halacha. We're just talking about unexplained white splotches that appear. Yeah.
Did it ever cross your mind that this sounds like a dermatologist checking for skin cancer? It's just as you're talking about it, it's crossing
well,
my mind.
Well, obviously, you know, there are medical parallels, but that's what where the Rambam made the point that you know, it's not exactly the same. So what I want to talk about is, I want to talk about, this is very technical, obviously, and the halachas are complicated, but the question is, what message might it have for us in our own avodas Hashem? So first of all, it should be pointed out, it's obvious, that the mitzora is of course tame, just like a tame mace is tame, and a mitzora cannot enter the Beis HaMikdash. But a mitzora is the only form of tumah in the whole Torah who is excluded not only from the Makam HaMikdash, which is called the camp of the Shekhinah, but is also excluded from the camp of the Levim, and even from the camp of Machne Yisrael. There is no tumah other than a mitzora that is excluded from regular society. It is only the mitzvah. Now, it's not an absolute quarantine. His family can visit him, which once again, in fact, friends can visit him. People can visit him. His dwelling is chutz l'machaneh, but people are allowed to see him, which is another proof that you're not dealing with a contagious disease situation. So why is the mitzvah chutz l'machaneh? Why is he the only one that's chutz l'machaneh? So there are a few ideas here. One idea is that if we understand that mitzora is lashon hara. Lashon hara destroys communities. Lashon hara brings hatred and animosity into relationships. And because it is so destructive, it's like a cancerous force, we isolate the Mitzvah as if to say, you are too dangerous. You are like a cancer in society. You have to be excluded. So one idea is that we are communicating the notion that the Baal Lashon Hara needs to be isolated, not to wreak havoc on society. Another way of looking at it is, we want the Baal Lashon Hara to experience loneliness, to experience isolation. Because in some ways, by experiencing the pain that he or she caused, because women can be mitzvahs as well, the pain that they cause others, that's ma'orer a person to tshuva, meaning feel what you've done. That's yet another idea. And again, that's a mita keneged mita. You've destroyed achdus, feel what it's like to be isolated. Yeah.
Is that like the Baal Miklat?
Well, yeah, but the Eir Miklat is very different. Because the Eir Miklat were cities of Levim. They were regular established cities that had a regular stable population. Right? So it really wasn't quarantine. He was removed from his home, but he was in a functioning city. But this is very different. This is like only the Mitzvah.
Could it be that whoever's struck by this is, it's like he has to check what he's doing wrong.
Well, that's the other thing. The third idea of isolation is isolation gives a person a chance to think and reflect. In fact, the word, the English word for prison, penitentiary, comes to be a penitent. Of course, the way prisons have developed, they're not a great place for tshuva, although there are people who do tshuva in prison. There are people, but most of the time it doesn't work out in such a positive way, because what you're doing is you're taking, let's say, an 18-year-old kid who commits his first crime, and you're throwing him in with people who are, you know, rapists and molesters and murderers, and that's not going to be a great influence on a person. In fact, Lubavitcher Rebbe used to say, that's why he thought the Eir Miklat was the best type of prison, because you're taking the one who kills Beshogeg, who is careless, and you're putting him with Levim, Tzadikim, Talmidei Chachamim, so something good rubs off. Okay. Now, the Svarim tell us too, this is why the Kohen is so involved in the Tzaraz process. Because Tzaraz comes from an abuse of speech. So what's the solution? Not to talk? Not really. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to use our Koach HaDibor to heal, to build up, to make shalom. The Kohen's Midah is Oev Shalom V'Rodev Shalom. So we tell the Mitzayra, learn from the Kohen how to use your speech in a positive, good way. There's yet another point. I had mentioned a person's not a Mitzayra until the Kohen says he's a Mitzayra. One of the lessons of Tzaraas is the power of words, which is pretty amazing. People sometimes say, oh, what's Lashon Hara? It's only words. You know, the old childhood saying, sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me. It's only words. In point of fact, that saying is absolutely not true. The sticks and stones that break the bones may heal. But the hurt and humiliation, a person may carry their whole lives. I remember hearing an interview with Richard Nixon, who had already left the presidency. He had resigned in disgrace because of the Watergate scandals, if you remember those. And he was just talking about, I couldn't believe it, he was talking about the pain that he suffered in sixth grade on the playground. And somehow this was still on his mind. And there are world leaders who make decisions that can affect the world, which on some level are connected to things that happened when they were kids. We, you know, think about our own, you know, I mean, these things are very, very powerful, much more powerful than we would like to imagine them to be. So one of the lessons of Tzaraas is words are reality. In fact, there was an experiment. Now, I had heard that it was fake, so I don't want to say it as a definitive, but it had been reported that people examined water molecules under an electron microscope, so you could actually see the individual molecules of water. And when people said negative derogatory words, the molecules turned into ugly shapes. They responded in an ugly way because of the negative spiritual energy in the room. And when people spoke words of shalom, the molecules assumed beautiful shapes. As if to say that even in the physical bria, it responds to good positive energy versus negative destructive energy. Now again, I had heard later that some people claim it was a fake experiment, it was a made up thing. I don't want to say it as an authoritative source, but at least this is what was reported, and I saw the pictures. These beautiful pictures of molecules versus these messy pictures of molecules. Right, so this is part, some of the lessons. But now, let's focus on the Simone Tuma in particular, because this is something that's particularly interesting. Even if a person has the nega, he does not graduate to become a definitive mitzora unless one of three simanim erupts. So here is the idea. Initially, we put him into quarantine for 7 days to give him a chance to reflect, to think, to make a cheshbon ha-nefesh, to do tshuva. The thesis that we're going to say, again, it's based on the Drash V'Ayin, is that after day 7, if he has one of these three simanim of Tuma, Hashem is giving him a report card that he's not yet ready for the tshuva process. He needs to go back to the drawing board. And each of these three simanim represent a reason or a defense mechanism that we have that prevent us from doing tshuva. So just as the initial tzaras is a physical manifestation of a sin, the simanim of Tuma are a physical manifestation of the person's inability or unwillingness to do tshuva for that sin. And that's why he has to go back and rethink. Okay, first defense mechanism. When a person is confronted with undeniable evidence that he's doing something wrong, tzaras, I'm doing lashon hara, the very first thing that we shift to is we give ourselves excuses. We defend our position. The person deserved it. Or we say things, although it's not halakhically valid at all, it's true, which as everyone knows, is not a defense for lashon hara, but instinctively we say, what I said was true. Or the person did worse things. I could have said much worse. Or I'm defending myself, I'm protecting my family, or my kavanah is l'shem shamayim. Now in English, we call that type of defending whitewashing. So the black hair turning white means the person is trying to whitewash his culpability, not necessarily by telling other people. This may be an internal process. And if the Kohen sees that, the Kohen knows what's going on. The Kohen says, go back into quarantine and rethink your position. You're not ready to do tshuva until you acknowledge responsibility. You know, there's a famous passage from Rabbi Yosef Albo in the Sefer HaYikarim, which raises the question. We know that when Shaul HaMelech was commanded to kill Amalek, and Shaul did not complete the command, he did it 95%, but he spared the sheep, and more importantly, he spared Agag. And Shmuel HaNavi comes back, and Shmuel HaNavi says, why did you not carry out the commandments of God? And Shaul's first response was, I did everything Hashem wanted me to do. And Shmuel said, why do I hear the bleeding of the sheep? So Shaul then said, the people made me do it. So with Shaul, we have this notion of equivocation. First, denial, defense, denial. And then blaming others. Rav Yosef Albo says, that is why Hashem did not forgive Shaul's sin, and Hashem forgave David's sin with Bathsheba. Shaul's sin may not have been as bad as David's sin. Shaul's sin was a sin of omission. David, on some spiritual level, committed adultery. Yes, there was a get, etc., technically not. But spiritually he committed adultery, and he committed murder. He sent a man to his death. And David suffered, and David was punished, but David was ultimately forgiven. And indeed, from Bathsheba herself, he had a son, Shlomo HaMelech. who zeichet to build the Beis HaMikdash. And the Rambam writes, Mashiach will be descended not only from David, but Mashiach is descended via Shlomo HaMelech. Meaning David had other wives and other sons, but it's through Shlomo. So why was David forgiven and Shaul not forgiven? Rav Yosef Albo says, because when Shaul is confronted with his guilt, he denies, he equivocates, he passes the buck. When David is confronted, now Shmuel is already not alive, so the Navi that confronts David is Nasan HaNavi. And Nasan HaNavi comes and he gives David the famous parable about the rich man and the poor man. And the poor man had one little sheep, that was the only thing he had in the world, and the rich man took it and slaughtered it for his party. What should be? And David said, such a man is wretched, he deserves to die. And Nasan HaNavi, speaking truth to power, as we say, says to the David, you are that man. Now, David could have given all the heterim that the Gemara gives us. The Gemara, right, we learn in Yeshiva, the Gemara is a whole arichas. Everything David did was technically correct. That Bathsheba had been divorced because every soldier that went to war gave his wife again. And Uriah Hiti was sent to the front because he had violated a royal command and he was Chayav Misa. And anyway, some soldier has to go to the front, so why not him? David could have given every single excuse that Chazal put into give us. Chazal give him all these excuses. David only said two words. Chatasi Lashem. I have sinned. No excuse. No blame. No passing the buck to somebody else. Taking responsibility. Hashem, Rav Yosef Albo says, does not expect a Manig Yisrael to be perfect. Hashem does not expect a Manig Yisrael not to make mistakes or not to fail. But Hashem does expect that when there is that failure, the manik takes the responsibility. And David, of course, yarshin this all the way back from his ancestor Yehuda, that when Yehuda was going to burn Tamar, his daughter-in-law, for committing adultery, whatever the exact avera was, because she was pregnant, and she said, the man who gave me this staff and this money belt, that was Yehuda, and she was not going to reveal his identity if he didn't come forward. As Chazal say, better to throw yourself in a fiery furnace, a kivshin o'esh, and not be malbin, p'nei chaver rab. That's Tamar's lesson. That's what we learn from Tamar. But Yehuda stepped forward and said, Sadka mimeni, she is more righteous than me. I was wrong. And that's really the first step to tshuva, to be willing to say, at least to ourselves, I was wrong. Sar Lavan means the person has not yet admitted to himself that he is wrong. He is still in the process of whitewashing, and as a result, the Kohen says, we're making you a mukhlet. You need more time to work on this. You need to understand your aver. You know, it's interesting, even to say, the Bali Musar say, even to say the words, I am wrong, is physically hard for us. This is what they say, yes, every person might be different. They tell the story in Navardic, which was kind of an extreme Musar, of two people were learning, and they had different pshatim in the Gemara, and finally, after an hour of arguing, one person says to his chavrusa, you're right. So since they were Bali Musar, the other chavrusa says, it's not enough to say I'm right. You have to say you are wrong. I am wrong. He says, what do you care? Don't bother me. He says, no, say the words. I am wrong. And that was a hard thing to do. I am wrong. That's a hard thing to say. Think about it even in terms of, well, okay, whatever, in the disagreements of husbands and wives, it's easier to say you have a point. We have ways of finessing things. He says, you might be right. You know, we like to finesse things instead of openly saying, I am wrong. David HaMelech's greatness is Chatasi Lashem. Okay. That is defense mechanism number one, denial and whitewashing. But there's sometimes another way a person responds to chait. And that might be by a hypersensitivity to guilt. A person might be so overwhelmed with their failure that they think they're beyond the point of no return. And they say, ay, 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 I messed up, I ruined things. I did so many bad things here. There's no way I could ever get out of this, so I'll just continue to throw good money after bad, so to speak. This is not an idea of rishus. This is not rishus. This is yiyush. Yiyush is a person just gives up. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we will die, taken from a pasuk from Yeshayahu, is not necessarily hedonism. It is sometimes the sense of desperation in which you feel there are no options. With Adam HaRishon, the Medrash tells us, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu confronted Adam HaRishon and said to Adam HaRishon, did you eat from the Eitz Hadas? Why did you eat? Or who told you you were naked initially? And Adam HaRishon, number one, he blames his wife. So we have that idea. That ties in. Of course, he blames that and he blames God, too. He says, he mentions it, the Isha that you gave me. Right, so he's getting thrown and he says, not my fault, her fault, and it's your fault. Okay, that's the first point. But there's another point that he makes that's also interesting that ties into the second thing we're saying. He said, I ate and I'll do it again. Ochalti v'ochalot. So some people understand that to mean defiance. But that's kind of dumb at this particular point. You want to plead for mercy from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You're not going to be defiant. I think the better way of understanding it is, he's not being defiant. Rather, he's telling Hashem, he is overwhelmed with the failure and the significance and the seriousness of what he did. He says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you gave me one commandment. I messed it up. And I know I'm going to do this again and again and again, and I can't help myself. This is the attitude of yish, of feeling there's no hope. And if you feel there's no hope, you just go into a downward spiral that never ends. That is the second siman of tumah, pisayon. The nega goes bigger and bigger. Not unlike the whitewash, which is the denial of guilt. Here, the sensitivity to guilt is so great that it becomes immobilizing, it becomes paralyzing. The person can't move, the person is stuck. And therefore the spiral continues to get worse and worse and worse. Here too, the Kohen says, go back and think about this. There is hope. There is the possibility of change. What you are today doesn't have to be what you'll be tomorrow. What you were yesterday doesn't have to be what you are today. Right? So the Pisayon and the Sar Lavan are both mechanisms that prevent us from tshuva, but in two different ways. The Sar Lavan is an externalization of our denial and our defense mechanism, and the Pisayon is a manifestation of our hopelessness and helplessness and sense that we are not worthy or capable of constructive truth.
So when the Kohen tells him to go through the doubt, he's not saying through the doubt for 7 days, he's saying, like, now you're a mukhba, right?
That's correct. Okay. That's correct. He only gets the other 7 days if there's no simon, because he's still in the process of the tshuva. Okay. Now, there is a third response, which you might call a non-response. And that is, the person is not consciously giving himself excuses, nor is the person overwhelmed with his guilt. He or she simply doesn't want to think about it. He creates a certain emotional distancing from a painful situation. Now, it might very well be that might commonly be a response to someone who, if they think about it, may turn into the second category of being so overwhelmed. In other words, so part of how a person continues to function is, how does the expression go? I don't let myself go there. Right? I don't want to go there. It is too painful. It hurts too much. I just don't think about it. Now, what that is doing is, that is putting an emotional distancing between your mind and your heart and the phenomena that needs to be corrected.
That is symbolized by the third siman, pisayon, michya it's called. Michya is, you're surrounded by the rot of a negatzaras. But in the middle of it, healthy flesh. That means I don't allow my heart to be cognizant of the spiritual rot that I am surrounded with. And that too is something in which you're distancing yourself from the aspect of tshuva. Now, it's a fine line. It is a fine line. It's a difficult issue. Because sometimes there is a risk that if we allow ourselves to dwell on these mistakes, it becomes so painful that we become paralyzed and depressed and unable to move on. So it's a fine line, and it takes maturity and strength to be able, and again, I'm not giving mushra to anyone, I mean, I'm speaking to myself as much as anyone else. It takes a great deal of spiritual maturity and strength to be able to confront our flaws, but not to become despondent over them. Not to either defend or deny, not to become despondent, but to understand. All of us have what to work on, what to change, what to improve. And we can do it. The Eibishter gave us the koach. Right? The koach, in fact, Rav Shach used to say, one of the lessons of terrorism in the world, you know, whether it's 9/11, suicide bombing, all the mechablim that we have in Eretz Yisrael, right, all these sorrows, which Baruch Hashem, which continue to have relative shalom, is that a mechabel teaches us how much one person can change things in an evil way. The power to change. Those people with the box cutters at 9/11, they changed the whole world. They changed everything. And they were nothing. They were nobodies. And the lesson is, if people who do evil can change the world, then people who do good can do more, can even do more so. Meaning the power of the individual to change reality. So, these are the three simanim of tuma. Denial, hopelessness, and emotional distancing and inertia. And in all three cases, the person has to go back. Now, if after 2 weeks, the person doesn't have those simanim of tuma, even if he has the tzaras, Hashem says go home, because what is that saying? You are ready to do tshuva, you can do it at home. You don't have to be in quarantine. Psychologically, you have done the inner work that will enable you to tshuva. So you still have to do tshuva because you have a neder. But you don't need the chutz l'machina, you don't need the korbanos, you don't need all the other rituals because you have prepared the groundwork to do the internal tshuva. So what is interesting about this is that these three simanim of tuma actually correspond to three symbolic meanings of chametz. You know, we recently left the Chag HaPesach, and the Maharal talks about, you know, chametz is bad, right? Chametz represents the Yetzer Hara. We know that. But in what way is chametz bad? In what way does chametz symbolize the Yetzer Hara? So the Maharal gives three explanations. The first explanation that is the best known explanation, and this I know that you've heard many times, is that chametz is puffed up and it represents arrogance, gaiva, as opposed to matzah that is flat, it represents humility. So one reason why chametz is a symbol of the Yetzer Hara is because chametz is arrogance. Now arrogance corresponds with the whitewashing, because when a person is arrogant, they're not willing to admit that they're wrong. In other words, everything they do is justified. Everything they do is right. It's always other people that are at fault. So the sar lavan, which is the denial and the whitewashing, does correlate to the arrogance in which a person is not able to see their own chasronos because of their gaiva. Now, the second symbolic reason, symbolic meaning Maharal gives is the following. Chametz represents evil because chametz spoils and rots as opposed to matzah that doesn't. Right? Bread will eventually have mold and go moldy and smelly, etc. As opposed to matzah, it may get a little stale, but you know, matzah can survive 1,000 years. I think they discovered matzah in Masada that was still Maybe they repackaged them in some of the shmur mas and the like. So chametz is evil because evil putrefies, gets rotten and moldy. Well, that corresponds to the hopelessness of pisayon, in which I think I'm so far gone, I'll just continue in my ways, get worse and worse and worse. The third symbolic meaning of matzah is, of matzah and chametz, is that chametz represents inertia and matzah represents action. What do we mean by this? When water falls on flour, you don't need to do anything to make it chametz. It will become chametz by simple inertia. If you do nothing to it, and 18 minutes pass, halachically, it is chametz. Chametz happens by itself. Matzah requires action. And the Maharal makes the point. You know, if I could bring in, I think it was Thomas Paine. It's a famous quote. Thomas Paine once said that the only thing necessary for evil to triumph in the world is that good people do nothing. It's not an exact quote, but that's kind of the overall message. And that is, evil kind of happens by itself. Goodness requires commitment, mesiras nefesh. Otherwise, things fall apart. A marriage requires a constant infusion of energy. Parenting requires a constant commitment. Things don't just happen by themselves in a good way. As the Chazanish said, no one ever needed to be mechanech a child, to have bad midos. That's kind of what happens unless we consciously strive to create a good environment. So chametz is inertia. Matzah is action. So that corresponds to the third idea of emotional distancing. Emotional distancing basically says, I'm not going to touch it. I'm not going to get involved. I will just ride this one out. And once again, one will never come to tshuva. So it's interesting that the three simonim of tumah, denial of sin, corresponds to arrogance, and that's the white hair. The second is the hopelessness of despair, corresponds to the rot of the chametz, and that's the pisayon, that's the expansion of the nega. And the third is emotional distancing, that corresponds to the michya, the healthy flesh that is surrounded by the rot, and that corresponds to the inertia of simply not touching. So it's interesting that there are correlations between the tumah of mitzora and the harchakos of chametz, the reasons why chametz is considered to be symbolic of the yetzer hara. So once again, although mitzora is indeed a very hyper-technical parsha, but there are, as everything in the Torah, there are going to be very valuable lessons in our own avodas Hashem, and may we use this time of sphere in a wise way, step by step, Madrega by Madrega. They're very good little books that they sell now based on Kabbalah, giving you like a special Aveda for every single day of Sfira. Again, I will talk about this in another shir in more Arichos, but it's actually very useful to have a concrete guide of something. Any swarmster, any bookstore will have it, yeah. A concrete guide as to what we can do during this period of Sfira. Have a good week.